So, tonight we are continuing with our Active Hope series. This is the 8th class, and we're talking about Chapter 9. And just a brief reiteration, the reason for this series, the reason I'm inspired to do it, is I want to encourage people to ask, am I doing all I can to fulfill my bodhisattva vow with respect to Earth and her many living beings? So our bodhisattva vow is to free all beings to... and if the answer, your answer to that question is yes, you are doing all you can, all you can fit into your life, that's fine. If the answer, like for many of us, is no, I feel like I want to do more, I would like to be able to do more, but that's a daunting thing to even open up to. Like, well, then what? The idea is then to support one another and finding a way to face that question, to practice with that question, to find a way forward. So that's why we're focusing on this book, Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. And it's written by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone. And Joanna Macy is a longtime Buddhist, but this book isn't explicitly Buddhist. But they talk about trying to cultivate active hope. So active hope is focusing on working toward what you hope for in the world rather than limiting your sense of hope to those positive outcomes you feel hopeful about. Like, it's likely to happen, I feel hopeful that. Which sometimes that can be very... there's not a lot to go on there at certain times. So this is focusing on working toward what you hope for in the world. And then this book is about how to do that, how to cultivate active hope. So tonight's chapter is called Catching an Inspiring Vision. So I'll read just a couple little excerpts here. So they're talking about imagination. And imagining possible futures is a surefire way to develop foresight. If we're only interested in facts, we limit ourselves to looking at what has already happened, which is a bit like trying to drive a car by looking only in the rearview mirror. To avoid crashing, we need to look where we're going. Since we can't know for sure what will happen, we are limited to considering possibilities, based on applying a combination of experience, awareness of trends, and imagination. While experience equips us well for dealing with familiar situations, our imagination is essential in formulating creative responses to new challenges. So they talk about how our imagination, especially in modern society, is kind of educated out of us. That a lot of education focuses on the left brain, not on the right brain, not on kind of images and artistic things and imagination. And in addition, they contrast static thinking with process thinking. So static thinking assumes that reality is fixed and solid, resistant to change. When people say things such as, the problem is human nature, it's never going to change, or you can't change the system, they're taking this approach. They are viewing situations as if they were like pictures hanging on a wall. If a new idea or way of doing things isn't already in the picture, it is seen as unrealistic. This view limits our sense of what is possible. If nothing inspiring is on the horizon, we can easily fall into apathy and resignation. With process thinking, we view reality more as a flow, in which everything is continually moving from one state to another. Each moment, like a frame in a movie, is slightly different than the one before. These tiny changes from frame to frame generate the larger changes seen over time. if something is not in the picture at the moment, it doesn't mean it won't be there later on. This way of conceiving reality sees existence as an evolving story rather than as predefined, because we can never know for sure how the future will turn out. It makes more sense to focus on what we'd like to have happen and then do our bit to make it more likely. That is what active hope is all about. So they contrast the photo frame, you know, whatever's in the picture versus, you know, the pictures in a movie. So this chapter, they say there are ways, and they have suggestions for how to kind of inspire ourselves and imagine and think creatively. They say these are learnable skills as opposed to, just figuring, oh, I don't have any ideas. I don't have any imagination. And they talk about the three practices that help us imagine. And the first thing is simply creating space. Then there's just intention and attention. And then there's a way to kind of capture the inspiration, writing or drawing or something like that. So in terms of imagination, I like to try to relate these kinds of suggestions back to Buddhism. And really, from the very beginning, you could think of Buddhism as being about imagination. You might not have thought of putting it that way before, but the story of Shakyamuni's search, or when he was Prince Siddhartha, and he looked out at the world and he saw just, you know, looks like people are just doomed to be happy sometimes, but then eventually they get sick, eventually they lose stuff, eventually they die. It's just, are we just kind of victims of our circumstances? We try to make our situation as happy as possible, but eventually it's going to change, and then we're going to be really, you know, sad and overwhelmed. And he just thought, there's got to be a better way. So in a way, from the very beginning, Buddhism is about thinking outside the box, about thinking there's got to be something else, some other way to live, some other way to be. Something beyond what he had already experienced, beyond what he had been taught, beyond what seemed possible, beyond what other people around him had experienced or thought was possible. So then that was when he awakened to what it was that he passed on to us as the Buddhist path. And another thread of this kind of imagination, it's like within each of us that same seeking mind arises, or we wouldn't be here. And so we call that Bodhi mind, or awakening mind, or the way-seeking mind. At some point, or maybe at multiple points in our lives, we said, wait a second, there's got to be a better way, there's got to be more, there's got to be something that I'm not seeing, something, some way. And so then we come seeking, and hopefully we find something of what we seek in our path. Maybe not everything we sought. Maybe we find things we didn't seek, but it's still a path of growth and discovery. And then I saw that recently Norman Fisher came out with this book, The World Could Be Otherwise. And what should he spend the first part of it talking about but imagination? So... And he tells this story. He also has used it in his Dharma talks. So he says, one day, this is about the French surrealist poet Robert Desnos. Desnos was Jewish. So he was captured and sent to the concentration camps. So he's one day, along with many other men, Desnos is crowded onto the bed of one of the trucks that transports prisoners from the barracks. The men fully understand where they are going. The trucks always leave the barracks full and return empty. Their destination is the gas chambers and the ovens. No one in the truck bed speaks. The mood is resigned, stricken, eyes lowered, faces grim. When the truck arrives, the prisoners slowly and silently descend as if in a dream. The guards, normally full of jokes and banter, fall silent, unable to avoid the prisoners' mood. But this almost religious silence is abruptly interrupted. One of the men in the line of prisoners suddenly, with great animation, jumps up, pivots, grabs the hand of the man behind him. Astonishingly, his nose almost touching the man's hand, his body coiled tight with energy, he begins to read the man's palm. "I am so excited for you," he says happily. "You are going to live a very long life. You're going to have 3 children, a beautiful wife, wealth, so fantastic, so wonderful." His excitement is contagious. First one man, then another, in shock and bewilderment, thrusts out his hand. Each one receives the same sort of prediction: long life, children, wealth, exciting career, beautiful surroundings, peace, happiness, success, joy unending. As Desnos reads palm after palm, the atmosphere of the moment, drop by drop at first, and then, as if in a sudden tidal wave breaking all at once, completely transforms. The prisoners are smiling, laughing, clapping one another on the back, their burdens lifted, their reality transformed. Even more astonishingly, the guards are also affected. Like the prisoners, they have been living a dark spell in which the marching of men to slaughter was a normal and acceptable everyday occurrence. But now, with this absurd and unprecedented event, this sudden and gratuitous evocation of an alternative reality, the spell is broken. The guards are disoriented, confused. The reality that had been living in a moment ago had been suddenly cast into doubt, all but shattered. They are no longer sure what is real and what is not. Perhaps their better natures, long suppressed in an effort to conform to the Nazi madness that defined their world, long numb to the grief, the guilt, the horror, were stirred by Desnos' powerful commitment to his absurd, but perhaps not absurd, vision. Who knows? They are in any case so undone by the jolly scene in front of them, they no longer know what to do. They can't go through with the executions. So they march the prisoners back onto the truck bed and send them back to the barracks. Through this spontaneous exercise of imagination, precisely the sort of move Desnos constantly makes in his poetry, he and these men were saved from execution. So then he talks about, and he hears this story from a poet who heard it from a scholar, who heard it from somebody who survived the camps. So he does this research to find out, like, is this a true story? Did this really happen? Is it exaggerated? And he finds out, like, you know, that as far as they can trace it back, the person who survived the camp, she had heard of it from other people who were there. So it seems fairly legit. But then at a certain point, he just realizes, because he's been just carrying this around as after he hears it as this kind of koan, and then he goes, you know, in a way, it doesn't really matter. I mean, there's a truth to it. As we hear it, we realize how this kind of thing can be true. So then he starts talking about imagination. And similarly talks about the Buddha's first experience. Says imagination expands our hearts and minds. It brings forth all forms of innovation, artistic, scientific, social. It spans myth, culture, religion, material progress. All idealism and moral vision depend on imagination. So does love. To go beyond one's own material and practical needs to loving care for another is the greatest of all imaginative acts. And then he talks about how the Mahayana, of course, goes even, I mean, talk about imaginative. It goes from the kind of down-to-earth, Four Noble Truths kind of deal, to they start saying, the Buddha was just an eternal cosmic principle. He may have appeared to die, but he didn't. He just appeared that way. In fact, he never entered the final passing into nirvana. How could he? For the Mahayana scriptures reveal the Buddha to be an endless illuminated, imaginative projection whose limitless purpose was the same as that of each and every human being. That purpose was compassion, the endless caring and salvific activity that would relieve the suffering of infinite beings throughout time and space. The Buddha portrayed by Mahayana Buddhist scriptures is the imaginary embodiment of love. Each person at the core is a Buddha in potential. And then he talks about how the our images of bodhisattvas, the bodhisattva path that we aspire to, said Mahayana bodhisattvas are the energizer bunnies of Buddhism. Innocent and enthusiastic, they make endless effort to do endless practice, to perform endless beneficial acts on behalf of others. Bodhisattvas are happy to defer their own awakening until every other sentient being is saved. In the many sutras and treatises, they touch on the bodhisattva ideal. Indo-Tibetan Buddhism has created a marvelous, extravagant, idealistic, and imaginative portrait of a perfect human being whose love and enthusiasm is literally boundless. And then he talks about the importance of ideals, that they're central to religion and to spiritual practice, to providing meanings to our in our lives. We cherish ideals as essential ingredients of our humanness. Without them, we slowly lose energy. We become boring, small-minded, and eventually depressed, as life's natural entropy overcomes us. And he talks about how we can overdo it as well. We can, you know, lose touch with reality and be attached to our ideals. But in terms of letting loose the imagination, as I was saying, these Macy and Johnstone talk about ways to do that. And one of the things that they make a good point, of course, is that when we're imagining things, brainstorming, it has to be without editing, which, you know, all of us do. It's like, I wish this would happen, but then we start to think, well, how could that happen? Is it likely to happen? And we immediately bog down our ideas in whether something seems possible or how that might be. Oh, people would never go for that, you know. So in a way, we have to let the imagination be free for it for a while. And they also point out something interesting called imaginative hindsight. So they said, research has shown that when people approach a problem by imagining that it has already been solved, and then look back from this imagined future, they are more creative and detailed in describing potential solutions. So if we kind of imagine, all right, somehow 30 years from now, we've turned this massive ship around, and we're living more sustainably, and we've learned to, you know, use resources in a reasonable way, and, you know, I'm sure it's always going to be messy, but we've found ways for things to be more equitable and fair and all this kind of stuff, right? So the ship's no longer sinking, we've stabilized. And then kind of thinking, well, how did that happen? How did we get there? So, I'm going to do an exercise. I always forget to bring in the the pads of paper. So please just hold up for a moment. The pads of paper and pencils, which they're really just, we're going to do a little bit of reflection, and if writing
jotting things down helps you reflect a little bit. That's fine. You don't have to write any more. But first we do a brainstorm together about what are some this 30 year, they say they use the 30 years from now as being, it's far enough out for something to have happened, but not so far, but close enough that at least some of us will survive to see it, we hope. So in this scenario where we have managed to create a life-sustaining society, what are some of the aspects of, what does it look like?
I'm sorry, I was talking.
So 30 years from now, we've managed to create a life-sustaining society. Not perfect, but you know, we've stabilized things. So what are some features of that? What has happened? What is true? What is the situation?
Refrain from using fossil fuels.
We've allowed our fresh drinking water to start, we've allowed it to start renewing itself as well as the oceans, because if we left it alone, water will do that.
Clean, healthy water system?
Right.
What was that? Oh. Yeah.
No borders.
Oh. No borders.
3 years.
Fake meat.
Fake meat.
Or less animal.
At least for us, Northerners with beer, no tea, no coffee. Chocolate. You can't grow it, you can't eat it. You have to transport something thousands of miles.
So to be more general, like maybe saying eating locally?
But you're not going to be eating all those exotics that we have to come.
Wait a minute.
Eating
locally or even shopping locally?
Small
purchasing.
On bikes, justice system. Mm. A fair and balanced.
What did you say, Zach?
Functioning government.
maybe restoration of true democracy.
Well, I would turn off the justice system, but generally, even more general than unfair justices.
I feel like there's a pair that's like increased population density where people live and rewilding the places where people don't live.
Hmm.
Let's
see. I'm kind of just, I mean, finding some kind of balance with nature, right? Living
protected green spaces. Like in Jane Jacobs' City of Nations, where we just protect the greener spaces. Nobody lives there.
There's also something to the absurdity of living on an 80 by 115 foot plot, because that's the only way I can be assured of not hearing my neighbors. And even that doesn't work much of the time, right?
If we just did a decent job of building apartment buildings, there would be no reason not to be in.
I would say maybe humane, clever living conditions for all. More community.
Zero population growth.
Yeah. Maybe decrease
population. Well, if you want a consumer economy, use a bad
one. It's like inflation. You want a certain population, not so much.
If you want a consumer economy, sure. But if you're trying to sustain a sustainable system, you can't just keep growing. We're past that point.
But we are just brainstorming now, so just putting ideas down. But you know, the idea that we can't.
While we're going for the imagination, I say corporations changing the way they operate and turning their attention for the good of the world instead of the bottom line. I mean, that's a huge one, but.
They already exist.
They just did.
Examples you mean,
Hmm? Huh?
You mean, when you say exist, you mean examples of that?
Yeah. I mean, there are official benefit corporations now.
Ethel was getting it less, like, I don't know how to word this. We look at our economy's health as how much we consume, less of a consumer ethos.
I want to see something like full cost of an item priced into the price of the item, right?
Yeah.
Material, energy, and recycling at end of life priced into the purchase price.
True pricing, true costs for future generations. Yeah.
Human labor. Automation.
I was going to say AI control.
I'm going to go the other direction. We're really inefficient.
Yes, this is the lovely world.
I'm thinking more of automated factories.
And
use a lot of energy to.
I remember reading a sci-fi novel where it basically had been at some point in a pivotal moment of their civilization. They said machines cannot do anything humans can do. If a human being can do it, you cannot make a machine do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, imagination here.
Imagination.
So,
it would suck.
I'm probably not totally investing in the industrial age or early, but the pre-industrial.
So, I mean, we could probably stop there. It's obviously not everything that we could think about, but the next step is unlocking a right brain imaging process. So the way that they recommend doing this is we close our eyes and then step into a happy childhood memory. Very happy, rich childhood memory. And just so that I know I can go on, when you have one, raise your finger. Right. So now that you have that memory, use all your senses in imagining the scene. Are you seated, standing, moving? Who else is with you? What are your surroundings? What are you doing? See the colors? Feel the textures? Smell the smells? Hear the sounds? Note expressions on people's faces? Emotions you are feeling? And where in the body do you feel those emotions? As much as possible, just try to reimagine that scene. And now, you can open your eyes. When using that same kind of imaging, actually, is what they call in this chapter. Imagine the world 30 years from now, the world that we have described over here. And you can imagine it, and we'll just leave some space, like I said. And what kind of image arises? And it doesn't have to be comprehensive. It doesn't have to cover all of these things or explain how we got there, but just what is something that you can see or imagine in this scenario? This scenario where we don't rely on fossil fuels hardly at all. Corporations are run to benefit much more widely all of society. We've dedicated ourselves to less economic disparity, clean, healthy water, less consumerism, considering the true cost of things when we price them, no borders, less dependent on animals, eating, getting our resources locally, a non-biased justice system, restoration of democracy, rewilding, living with nature, human labor valued, humane living conditions for all, more community.
I feel a sense of peace. Viewing intergenerational interaction, not just in families, but in neighborhood communities, and people aren't walking around with phones or devices, and nor rushing around. People, I see them conscious of what they're doing and going, not necessarily going to something, but being somewhere.
To build on that, I imagine, and I can just see in my neighborhood, like a house that was bought by the city and turned into a community center just for that neighborhood. The kids would go play there, and the elderly folks would come and get a cup of coffee there, and you just could go hang out there. Maybe you'd have a little cafe. Maybe that's where you would We would have some tools that we could lend out and borrow from each other. Get to know your neighbors.
Connection. More emphasis on human connection.
But Jeff, I just don't have a car. I just don't get to go. Like, I'm just going to go over to Fred Meyer and get done. Be like, hey, do you have a drill?
So we got the common house workshop.
Good.
More living like it. Mm-hmm. And just cooperative communities. Mm-hmm. Start sharing items.
I may be the only person I know who liked living in the dorms. So I pictured massive retro-futuristic arcologies with organic farms and terraces surrounding them. And people being able to walk everywhere because there's so much indoor space. And you might as well, you know, go hang out in an indoor park or out in the park. And community forming just because you're all next to each other all the time. I knew so much more space for nature. I actually did picture a lot of devices. I pictured a world where, you know, justice and democracy were all the time, not election-based, and where, you know, maybe people were free to accumulate wealth, but they weren't free to accumulate carbon. You couldn't draw massive carbon debt, and everyone understood that they were interdependent there at that carbon level. And then everyone would feel a responsibility to maintain the system that they're all in together, because there's no buying their way out of trouble.
I will add to that and say that this culture has a deep respect for science and the scientific method, and is willing to bend views and beliefs to what can be demonstrated to be true, and actions are taken to support this community based on those kind of principles.
One thing we didn't get on there, why don't we do this thing? I think we probably spend with total waste, more money on it, conflict, investor of military conflicts, reduction and individual elimination of conflict. What that money could be, reduction and eventual elimination of conflict, what we spend on wars would feed everyone, would solve many of our problems.
I'd say one of the exercises is to kind of have a dialogue with that, the future generations that are living this, and like explain. And one of the things, you know, the no borders, immediately, that can't be that. But I heard once somebody point out, well, within our country, we don't have any borders. You can move to any whatever city or state you want. Some of them are rich and some of them are poor, and some of them are growing and some of them are shrinking, and we don't do anything to try to stop that. It's just all, so it is possible. So, and as you were talking, I was thinking about, at some point, you know, we do have these social movements that change the way that we think. You know, civil rights and women's rights, and just to imagine a society becoming more aware of the ways that we're ruled by our emotions and biases instead of by wisdom.
I'm reading a book about that right now, and it's like, just as in practice, we become more aware of our delusions. Our society can go through a transformation where it starts to acknowledge, yes, we're going to tend to go toward greed, hate, and delusion unless we really watch out for that.
Tatiana Kennedy Schlossberg, John Kennedy's granddaughter. And one premise in that, she, and I haven't read the book, I'm going to, but I read a review, and it says, if 3 to 4% change of behavior, then she's right about climate change. It's not going to make any difference. But if 3 or 4% of people push for systemic change, it will make a difference. So that's your point. You can't save yourself out of the situation. You can only become active to push for change to get us out of the situation.
Any more visions of the future unrestrained by how difficult it might be to get there? You have the visions of the rewild green spaces?
Also in the future, a respect for whatever ancestral lineage people feel drawn to, that is respected and supported in whatever way people want that to be, because that's part of human history, and that honoring is regarded.
Well, I was going to say, like you mentioned science fiction, I'm a longtime reader of the Ringworld series, and one of the things they have in there is the floating city that has all of the rooftops covered in what we would call today photovoltaic cells, because there's enough energy falling on the earth from the sun right now, every day, to power the entire planet multiple times over, simply by utilizing all of that radiated energy from the sun. We could turn this into a much better place, because once you take that energy and you convert it to electricity, and then of course we'd have electric cars, electric houses, we'd have electric trains, not using diesel. We already have electric buses and 18-wheelers, all running on electricity from battery packs. And these are long-term sustainable devices. It's not like you're drilling for oil that is depletable. That creates a mess, even getting it out of the ground, much less refining it and so forth. So this is my dream, is to have...
So you're picturing our roofs covered in these photovoltaic cells.
Yeah. And that's the size of Texas. That's the power of the whole planet. It doesn't have to be Texas, but it has to be that size.
There's
yes.
a place where roads are solar panel roads in Idaho.
I would like to see one of our Scandinavian countries. There's a lot of ways to capture energy.
Mm-hmm. Nice story.
We still have to consume less, but I'm kind of picturing, like, basically everybody gets a certain ration of carbon or energy. Mm-hmm. Everybody who's born gets a certain ration. If you want to, you know, have a yacht and a private jet, then you buy those rations from other people. And therefore, they have resources to do other things. I'm also picturing like a high speed train.
Yeah.
All on the West Coast, right? So instead of having to go down to San Francisco and spend the night on the train, could probably be there in I don't know. How long would it even take to get to San Francisco on a bullet train going hundreds of miles an hour?
Yeah. 2 to 3 hours.
But, you know, we talk about consumption, and the thing is that we don't really necessarily have to eliminate or lessen consumption that much, meaning a lessen extraction. We just reuse our stuff, rebuild it, reformat it. We can still have stuff. Just that we're not knocking down hills and mountains, tearing pits to get to it.
You're reminding me of the, kind of imagining a future. I don't know if anybody ever seen this book, this picture book. I think it's called The Material World. And they all over the world, they took pictures. They had families take all of their stuff out of their house. And they took a picture of the family with all their stuff in front of their house. And if you can imagine, I don't even think they made the Americans and I don't even think they made them take all their stuff out. That couldn't have been all their stuff. But it was still just like, you know, a mountain of stuff. And then, you know, there's these other places in the world where they have this simple house and they have like, you know, a selection of pots. And people who looked like they were living, they weren't starving, they were living just fine. And you imagine, like, what if that's kind of, you know, that's what you had and you treasured that, you cared about it, as opposed to it just being like.
This book comes out with food as well. Hmm. And there's food spread out.
Wow.
Between like Japan and America.
Interesting.
It's neat to see the transition where meat starts showing up in their food allotment quite a bit more, and then when you get to Western nations, all of a sudden, it's all pre-prepared foods in plastic bags. Right? You go from one end of the world where it's, you know, things you recognize as food, you know, beans, rice, vegetables,
right.
And then bags of chips, bags of potatoes, you know, cases of beer.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just thinking of, you know, one thing that's not here is sort of celebration of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that feeds into borders and less tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's conflict.
Conflict.
Mm-hmm. And when we were talking about zero population growth and we need a certain amount of growth, but if you still want to expand the economy, you can start by improving the economic status of almost 30%.
Well, cut the military budget over there.
That helps too. That's,
yeah.
Cutting the military budget would be painful in and of itself because it would disrupt our economy.
Right. But now we're imagining. We're imagining. We're not imagining how we get there. We're just imagining that, like, so I'm picturing this, maybe 30 years is too soon, but some future generation is saying, you know, they used to spend that much? What were they spending it on? What was that for? Now we just have these, you know, we have some people, they serve as peacekeepers, and, you know, everybody has to do a stint in the peacekeepers. But, you know, they don't do a whole lot.
Well, this one shaman said, peace is not the opposite of war. It's that recognized tension that we need to live with, that a level of awareness.
Mm.
Because it's not just, oh, no more war.
No more conflict, no more problem.
Right,
I mean, because we talk about living in community,
right.
But as Gathel knows, you know, and I've lived in community as well. Community has a challenge, it's compromises, it's everything. So yeah, not expecting it to be perfect, not expecting it to be without, learning how to deal with that, learning how to.
Living with that, your board, those concepts, gratitude would be a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
As well as perhaps maybe even wisdom.
Who knows?
I mean, the most exciting, I don't know if you got your rewilding idea from this book that's called, I think it is called Wilding, about the British farm that they turned back to the wild, but in a particular way, not just walk away and neglect it. They introduced animals and ecological aspects back to it so that it came as close to a functioning system as it used to be. And the transformation is just absolutely awe-inspiring. They put back like cattle, like there would have been big herbivores. They put back wild pigs, deer, and they eat some of the cattle. Like they sell it as, you know, it's like super organic green. So every once in a while they cull some of the cattle and are paying for this project that way. But these, just the whole thing is changing. The plants are changing. The pigs dig up all the invasive weeds. There's worms and microorganisms in the soil now. The rare butterflies are coming back. Bird species are coming back. Like, and it makes me feel like we could do this. This is not like a huge, this isn't rocket science. This is just, you know, letting nature do its thing again.
There's apparently a movie, I don't know if anyone saw it recently, mentioned it, but it's in California, and basically do the same thing. They reclaim farmland that is fallen fallow and wasteland, and by farming it with these earth-friendly methods, they've reclaimed it and turned it into a beautiful garden.
Hmm. Yeah, because this farm in England, they stopped using it. It wasn't producing anymore.
Yeah, it's the same.
It was waste. It was wasteland.
You got these big clods of dirt. They're all dry.
Yeah.
With that.
Well, it's 9 o'clock. Thank you for spending some time in this zone.